Welcome to 20 Minute Takes. My name is David DeLeon, and I help to produce this podcast. To wrap up our first season, we're dropping a two-part interview with Andre Henry. Andre is a musician, activist, and author of the recently released book, All the White Friends I Couldn't Keep. He's also the program manager for Christians for Social Action's Racial Justice Institute. In this conversation, Nikki talks with Andre about the genesis of his book, The Truth-Telling Power of Anger, and some insights on nonviolent action. Listen in.
Andre, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You know, Andre, one of the things as I read your book, All the White Friends I Couldn't Keep, I was really struck by your love for your people. And I think you're really generous with how you define your people. What are you hoping that your people get from this book?
Well, yeah, I think from the start, in the before the intro, I include something that a literary agent told me a few years ago, that you write a book not to express yourself, but because you care about your people. And yeah, I really did think about that in writing the book and what would be helpful. So I know that a lot of people, a lot of different kinds of people probably read the book, but I was really thinking of Black men like myself who are where I was maybe 6 years ago, you know? And I was really thinking of, and I know some Black men who are still there, that kind of haven't woken up yet entirely to the ways that we internalize the lies of the white world.
Wow.
And the way that I think, the reason why I specifically thought about Black men, because I want to be clear that, like, let me just put it another way. Almost everything that I've learned about social justice, I've learned from Black women.
Wow. Okay.
Like, there's a whole group of Black women, and I think about them like every week. Every week, I just want to like make an Instagram post of a slideshow of them and just thank them publicly.
Yeah.
For all that they've taught me, and so that's why. So when someone hears that I had Black men in mind, I don't want for them to think that like I was trying to be exclusionary. I want for them to understand that like Black women have been such a catalyst and such a catalyst for me in my own decolonizing journey.
Yes.
That I've been thinking about Black men in my life that are still kind of in the place that I was, you know, years ago, and wanting to give them something to say, you're not crazy if you feel like something is wrong.
Yeah.
And for them to discover freedom, you know, or to embark on the freedom to be their full selves. And beyond that, you know, beyond that kind of more narrow idea of who my people are.
Yes.
I'm thinking of Black people in general, in the sense of offering them the things that I've learned about nonviolent struggle, the practical insight about nonviolent struggle. Because I think that this is information that it's not that we don't have access to, obviously we have the internet, but it's not mainstream. It's not a part of our common sense. When I went on my own journey, I started learning all these things that I wish that everybody knew. And so I was like, when I was approached about doing the book and working on the book proposal, all that kind of stuff, I was very intentional about, yes, I think that people will be drawn in by a personal story and all of that, but I'm going to sneak this information in there.
Well, I think that's one of the things that's so great. It's like, it feels like it's sort of a memoir, like we're going on your journey. And then it also feels like a history lesson distilled down, as well as a lot of social commentary, helping us understand the events of today, the events that we're living through right now, as well as a little bit of consciousness raising. It's sort of amazing how you've wrapped all of those things in one book in between two covers.
It's kind of like when someone is playing the piano, but they don't know music theory, like, and they do things that break the rules, but it works and they don't know.
Well, it works. I will tell you, it works.
Because I didn't realize that these are genres that don't usually mix, you know. It was just kind of how my brain works, and my editors at Convergent really helped, you know, help the seams come together. But I remember the early drafts of like the book proposal, it was really difficult. Structure was a huge challenge.
That's fantastic. I think one of the things that I notice is there's something of a theme of a story mm-hmm. that you carry through for part of the book. And it's this dynamic that you had growing up as a Black man and your mm-hmm. relationship with a Southern white family. And I think one of the things you talk about is the way that we can sort of otherize racism, or sort of say, oh, you know, it's this thing that's over and next to, but not the thing that I'm in. And I think that contrast sort of lays out one of the extreme contrasts in the US. And yet you invite us to sort of say, hey, actually, you know, what stories are we a part of? Can you talk a little bit about that advice that you have for people to not be too quick to sort of say, oh, that's a story that belongs in that extreme? Why did you share, I think, your journey?
That was a huge myth that was very prominent when I was growing up. And I think it's one that white America is fighting for right now, you know, to say that we don't have to talk about racism anymore because we don't have plantations and Jim Crow laws.
I didn't own slavery.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that we have to, why am I being so careful about this? It's as simple as cause and effect, right?
Okay.
Like, America was founded by these white, many of them slaveholding men, right? They were a part of the British imperial system first. Basically, they just decided they didn't want to be British anymore, but they still wanted to do pretty much the same thing they were doing as, you know, British imperialists. And we never really had a thorough changing of that system, basically, right? So, you know, like, I think that Isabel Wilkerson compares this to a house in her book Cast, right? Like, I mean, you build a house, if there's dry rot in it, you know, like, that's still a part of the structure of the house. It doesn't matter if you built the house or not, you know, like, you're living in it, you know? And we are living in the house that America's founders built. Now, at this time, and I think throughout our history, like, there has been this extreme, I shouldn't say extreme, there has been this denial of that fact, right? Wow. That it is consequential that the house was built that way, right? And so I tell my story personally because I always thought, or at least initially, I thought that was that's the best evidence that I have, you know, is that I have an experience of living in this house, you know, like, my family has a house in Stone Mountain that is very old. And on the bottom floor of the basement, we've built bedrooms down there and we've always had a mildew problem down there. So I don't know a whole lot about mildew, but I know what it smells like. I know it's all over my brother's book bag. I know that some people have trouble breathing because they've been down there. So I have always felt that personal experience was one of the most potent, you know, ways of knowing. And this is something I'm trying to add to, you know, I don't think that personal experience is enough. You know, you do something bigger. And that's why I try to connect it in the book with the broader historical context, with statistics and studies and all of that.
I love that. I mean, it reminds me of, there's a section too where you talk about anger and you talk about the truth-telling nature of anger. Can you say more about that? Because I feel like the topic of anger for the Black community is a little loaded. And in general, it seems like at least I've been socialized to respond to anger by containing or suppressing. But it seems like you're exhorting us to look at some of that a little differently. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, I think that people who belong to marginalized groups or persecuted minorities in some way are often taught that we are often taught to, like, regard some emotions as off limits because it makes the system of domination work more smoothly. And so, like, I think that, you know, it's the tone policing, really. I don't think that I use that word in the chapter on anger, but that is really what it is that the system tone polices. And if we understand that individuals can become agents of the system at any moment, like pretty much like the Matrix, right? Like, you know, anyone can become Agent Smith at any moment. You know, the tone policing, I think, is meant to keep us in place. And so one thing that I think that, you know, with the way that this happens with Black people is that we have these tropes of the angry Black woman or the angry Black man. I hear all the time, you know, not just about anger, but about feelings in general in our society. You know, it seems like people regard pathos as something that is not trustworthy, right? Because they can be, it can feel chaotic to be in your feelings.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. But I think that this is in some ways a way that we're being told that we have to separate from our bodies, you know, because our bodies actually hold truth. They know truth. They communicate truth to us.
Wow.
And in, when you tell, and the advantage of telling marginalized people, persecuted minorities, oppressed people, not to trust their bodies, is that you can do things to our bodies and with our bodies and have us split ourselves and say, okay, well, I don't have to trust myself. I'm supposed to trust the overseer, the slave master, the Bible, the preacher, the pastor, the president, the governor, whoever, you know, trust authority.
Yeah.
And I lived like that for a long time. I didn't want to be labeled an angry Black man. So eventually I submitted to the tone policing for so long that I really believed that I didn't have any Black rage.
Oh, wow.
And then all of a sudden, you know, in 2016 sometime, I found, it was like after I started cutting white people off, I started finding all of this rage inside of me.
Is that right?
That had been there for a long time. When I look back on it, if I put my story on a timeline, there's a very angry little boy, Andre. And he was angry about racism at nine. Right. And then there's this whole section, like from 10 to 29.
Wow.
Where I don't think that I could really locate that anger for you, except for these little moments where I did feel angry. Someone tone policed me. I put it back in the box.
Is that right? You know? Wow.
Right. And it was in that summer of 2016 when I was able to admit to myself, I am angry about this. I am enraged about this, that I thought of Moses, you know, who, you know, his story begins with his story of, you know, kind of, I guess you could say he was decolonizing, even though that's an anachronism, that he found this rage at injustice when he kills the Egyptian who was oppressing his fellow Hebrew.
Yes.
He was not, I mean, probably not the best to like play vigilante and, you know, like, but I feel that that anger was something that God used, you know, in his story. And then I started like, oh my gosh, it was that summer that I first read James Baldwin and heard Stokely Carmichael and heard Fannie Lou Hamer speak and all these others, because, you know, not up to that point, but for the most part, we're given Dr. King, you know, in America.
Right.
We've made Dr. King a model minority and said everyone has to be like this whitewashed version of Dr. King. So I started hearing all these other voices that were livid and incisive and articulate and free. And it just opened up this whole world of possibility for me to understand that anger can be a constructive force for social progress. And I started looking at those voices and saying, I want to be like them.
Wow.
You know, but, and even Dr. King was angry too. Like before I get off of that, like Dr. King was also angry, you know, you could see it in his face. You could hear it in his voice, you know?
Yes. That's amazing how you've kind of reclaimed anger. I was also really surprised because you talk about that listening to anger, but then one of the responses that you're exhorting is this nonviolent response. And to me, that was a bit of a surprise. But can you say more about how those two kind of go together?
Yeah, I remember. So Dr. King and Gandhi say something really interesting about nonviolence. And in this area, I think that is relevant. So basically, Gandhi said one time that he could take a violent man and teach him to be nonviolent. And King repeated this because he was very influenced by Gandhi. But the thing they both said that they couldn't do is work with, you know, basically a coward. That's what that's their word. They said they can't work with cowards, but they can work with people who want to do something, because when we talk about nonviolence, we're talking about action, right? And I don't think that a lot of people, I think that is the, I was just talking with my friend Eric Stoner, who runs a blog called Waging Nonviolence. And we were talking about this, how we talk about nonviolence as nonviolent struggle, you know, for us who are trying to organize this. But most people just use the phrase nonviolence. And I think that a part of what's happening, or what has happened, and it's unfortunate, is that we have intellectualized nonviolence and made it abstract. We've made it something of just a value that exists in our hearts and minds. Instead of praxis, you know, nonviolence is an adjective for a type of action that we're supposed to be taking, right? And so, whereas at one point in history, it seemed like the nonviolent part of the phrase nonviolent struggle needed to be emphasized, because up to that point, we had mostly seen people liberate themselves through conventional warfare or guerrilla warfare or something like that. So we had to emphasize the nonviolent part of the struggle. But now I think we have to emphasize the struggle, or the direct action part of that phrase, because now people are just talking about like nonviolent communication and nonviolent, you know, this and that. And it's like, okay, sure, but but it's becoming too individual, too personal. It's not about collective action. So the way that anger comes in is that anger is energy. You feel anger, you got to do something. You got to take a walk. You got to run. You got to sing. That's, you got to do voo breath.
That's,
you got to do something with that anger, because it just, it's inside of you, makes you want to do something. So how this occurred to me at first, I mean, it's not like a new thought, but the way that I started our talking about this was that anger is the shadow side of hope. You know, it's the shadow, or not shadow side, but it's hope's shadow.
Yeah.
That anger tells us in our body something is not right. I don't like what's happening right now. Maybe a boundary has been crossed. Maybe a value has been undermined, or whatever. Well, that means that you probably have some idea of how things should be. If you know that things are wrong, you probably have some idea of what's right. And so lean into that. That's where your vision of tomorrow is, which is essential, you know, for pursuing change. And then use all that energy that you have and put it in, put it behind that vision of tomorrow. And just don't hurt anybody, you know, like just put it behind that vision of tomorrow and don't punch anyone in the face. Don't shoot anybody, you know, all that kind of thing. But I think that it's like one more thing, just is that it touches on this misconception that people think that nonviolence is just something that you say, when really it is active. It's not passive.
I love that. And it seems like such a different response than we've been told or trained to respond to anger.
Thanks for joining us for part one of our conversation with musician, activist, and author Andre Henry. The second part of this conversation will be released next week. 20 Minute Takes is a production of Christians for Social Action. This podcast is hosted by Nikki Toyama-Sito. Our music is by Andre Henry. This episode was edited by Eddie Koffoltz and produced by me, David DeLeon. If you want to learn more about our work, visit christiansforsocialaction.org. And if you've appreciated season one of 20 Minute Takes, give us 5 stars, write a review, and pass this podcast along to your friends. Thanks.